Okay, most people are here. Excellent. Never know until the last minute what I'm going to talk about, because I'm one of the monks who just doesn't do any planning. Because you find that too much of the time when you have plans what you're going to do in the future, even what you're going to talk about in the next hour, sometimes it means, number one, you don't pick up on the energy of the people in front of you. Number two, it means you can't innovate, you can't sort of find new ways of doing things. One of the great things about life is when you have plans, you always go the same old ways you've always gone before. When you don't have plans, you can go new journeys, new paths, experiment, investigate, find out. And that becomes a source of much wisdom. So never be a person who always plans, otherwise you become creatures of habit. For example, when you first wake up in the morning, what do you do? Try and do something different tomorrow morning, just for the hell of it. For example, you may ask yourself when you brush your teeth, what part of the teeth do you start at? Are you one who starts at the top left-hand corner, the top right-hand corner, the bottom middle, or where do you start? Tomorrow, start somewhere else. As I say, live on the wild side. Do things differently, because when you start doing things differently, straight away you stop this habitual nature of the mind, always to do things in the same old way, which kills you. So innovation, seeing things anew, doing things differently, is a great sense of freedom, adventure, discovery, and that's where you get wisdom from. And it makes life alive rather than dead, always being creatures of habit. The more you follow habit, the more dull you get. Not only dull, you get depressed. Life doesn't have any meaning anymore. So it's great to sometimes do things differently. And when you do things differently, you see things differently, you are literally living outside of the box. That's what monks and nuns do. We live totally outside of the box. We have great fun being out of the box people. By which I mean that sometimes you have to go to, you know, places like the Social Security and they always ask for your ID. You have to prove you exist. So they ask for your bank account details. And we don't have bank accounts. We don't have any money, nor credit cards. So they ask for your marriage license, your mortgage agreement. We don't have those either. How about a driving license? No, we haven't got that. Your tax file number. We don't earn any money. We haven't got tax file numbers. We don't exist. All the things which define you, we don't have. We literally are out of the box people. And because you live out of the box, you live in different ways. You can actually see things from different angles, different perspectives. And that's where you get great wisdom from. Seeing things from a different perspective. And that's what we've been teaching. I'm teaching a retreat, a 9-day meditation retreat down at Jhana Grove. So I'm just moonlighting by coming here this evening and teaching you. But I always like to do the Friday night talk. But it's also, when you see things differently, you can get some great understandings of some of the problems which people have. And one of the problems which has come up in the meditators when I do interviews with them, find out how the meditation is going. This is a terrible Western disease of lack of self-worth. It's amazing just how many times people really should be developing wonderful meditation. It's just so easy. You rest, you become peaceful, things start to happen, and then you stop. You're afraid. I don't deserve this. This first happened with an Australian Buddhist nun many years ago who was spending a retreat with me at our monastery down at Serpentine. And of course her meditation was going really, really well. She got very, very close to these amazing meditations called jhanas, but she couldn't go any further. And I was interviewing her. Why? What's the problem? There seemed to be no reason. And then she spilled the beans. She told me that she didn't think she deserved so much happiness. And from that time on, I recognize there's such a great lack of self-esteem amongst Western people, especially. And those people who had a Western education, like all the Sri Lankans in front of me, that you can't achieve much in life, what you really should be achieving, your peace, your happiness, your freedom, happy relationships, success in your life, good health. You can't achieve all that. Why? Because I don't deserve it. And it all comes from when you were very small, when you were at school, and you never came top of the class. Even if you did come top of the class like I did, then I was sent to a bigger school where it was even harder to become top of the class. And unless, as a guy, you're smart, in England you can play soccer really well, and you've got lots of good friends, and you've got lots of girlfriends, other than that, you're a failure. And girls, unless you're incredibly beautiful like some supermodel, but also brilliant in all your subjects, and good at sport, and popular with your friends, and good with your family, in other words, your mum and dad like you, other than that, you're another failure. The bar is set so high in our Western world that hardly anyone can actually reach that bar. And we always grow up thinking, we are inadequate. There's something wrong with me. And for most of your life, because that's where we start from, we have to struggle so hard to try and get some acceptance, some love from other people, and even harder from ourselves. So those of you who have kids especially, for you, please don't do the same to your children. Think of your poor kids. You want them to do really well at school. You want them to go to university, and you give them such a hard time. Not all the kids can come top of the class. Not all the kids can become doctors and engineers and lawyers. And anyway, as I often say in Buddhist groups, if you are a parent whose children come top of the class or in the top 5%, or if they come in the bottom 5%, you are not a good Buddhist parent. Because in Buddhism, we believe in the middle way. So if your child is in the middle somewhere, well done, that's a good Buddhist parent. So yes, some kids, they will excel naturally. But the rest of them, they have so much pressure put on them at home. Come on, you're not doing good enough. Come on, you only come second last year. I want you to become first. Now that's what they get at home. Now what do they get at school from the teachers? Come on, you've got to try harder. What do they get from their friends? The competition which boys and girls have in the schoolyard. I remember just being a young boy. The peer pressure amongst the boys. You had to be cool. You had to be strong. You had to be attractive. As girls, it's even worse. You know, I remember just coming. I was coming here to give a talk. I was on the bus sitting behind two girls coming from school, maybe 14 or 15 years of age. They were talking. These were the best of friends. And I listened to what they were saying to each other. You've got a big nose. Yeah, but you've got flat breasts. You're never going to get a boyfriend. Yeah, neither are you. And this is the best of friends. I don't know what the enemies say to each other. Do you remember that from your school days? We're always so picky on each other, always finding fault with each other. And after a while, that some children, they succumb. That's all they hear, is being put down, not good enough. And sometimes the parents, well, we love you, but why the hell don't you say so? Not just with I love you, but oh, it doesn't matter. You know, you've come sort of second from bottom. That's an improvement from last year. Well done. Because a lot of times that's all that people need, encouragement. When you get encouragement, then actually you do well. People need more praise. And because they always get criticism again and again and again in their life, they lose their sense of self-esteem. They always think there's something wrong with them. Have ever you in your life, and you look to yourself in the mirror, something's wrong with me, I'm not sure what, I wish somebody would tell me, but there's something wrong with me. No. If you look at your kids and give them encouragement rather than than blame. Say, well, you know, you're doing reasonably well. Not everybody can sort of go to university, but many successful people didn't go to university. They dropped out. Steve Jobs, Einstein left university. You can be pushing your kid to go to university, and that can be destroying their potential to be another Steve Jobs or an Albert Einstein. So if your kid doesn't want to go to university, great, wonderful, brilliant. In other words, whatever your kid does, please build them up. Please love them. Please say to them, well, it's okay, you know, if you don't do well at school, if you don't pass your end of the year exams coming up now, if you don't go to university, that's fine. You know, there's always things you can do. Because if that's what you receive, rather than criticism, but you receive some praise for a change, imagine what it feels like. I spent most of my life, you know, being sort of the leader of Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpent, building up my monks. So whenever they come and they say, oh, I tried to meditate today, I fell asleep. I say, oh, very, very good. So at least when you're falling asleep, you don't break any of your precepts. So whenever they say, oh, yeah, you know, I'm just really stupid, I can't remember the chanting, I say, well, you know, there's other great monks who could never do any chanting. That's not so important. So when you actually build people up, it's amazing just what they can achieve. You know, that's all they really want, is a little bit of respect, a bit of acknowledgement that they're okay. And then this terrible thing, this must be something wrong with me, just disappears. So when you look at yourself, is there something wrong with you? What you've done, if you think like that, is you've just accumulated just all those criticisms of the past, and you believe them, and you just become an inadequate person because you believed all of that. So over in the retreat, I was teaching them the way to overcome that negativity, the way to let go of the pain of your past. Now, it's very easy to say, oh, just let it go. It's the past, it can't be changed, leave it alone. But it's not that easy to do just through an act of will. You have to actually do something. Every psychologist, and as many psychologists come here, they know if you are going to let go of something, you have to do something, to visualize it, to act it out as drama or painting or something in order to help with the letting go of the pain of the past so you can feel free and you can do whatever you want in life. So I developed the method which is based on some psychology, and I taught this at a psychology conference over in Sydney in August, and I've also been teaching this at Jhana Grove, and many people have found great success in this over the last week. If you have got some bad memories of the past, what people have said to you, what they've done to you, then the first thing you do have to do is acknowledge it, bring it up, and one of the best ways of doing that is to write it down. Write it down on a piece of paper, clearly, as much as you can, as accurately as you can, because when you're writing it down, you're bringing it up to the surface, you're acknowledging it, and it's there before you, you're seeing it, you're not in denial anymore. And the best piece of paper to use for writing down all those painful, terrible experiences of your past is what we call toilet paper. Because it's on toilet paper that all the shitty stuff of life belongs. So you write down all these terrible things which your husband has done, your father, your parents have done, your wife, your kids have done, your boss at work has done, all these terrible things which have happened to you. You write them down on the piece of toilet paper. And then you read them. You acknowledged it. And then the final act of letting go. Yes, you've guessed it. You take the piece of toilet paper to the toilet where it belongs. And you put it in the bowl and you flush it. Bye-bye, past. Because that's where the shitty stuff belongs, on the toilet paper and down into the sewers, wherever it goes. And people have done that down at a retreat center, and that's why many of the toilets are now blocked. So much stuff. You know it actually works. So you try that. Because that's the only way to let these things go. So somehow you can be free. You don't have to believe in all that pain of the past. And in the meantime, don't collect more shitty stuff. But, you know, we develop this positive mind state. Now, develop that positive mind state so you can actually receive praise. And this was a story I told before the Range Retreat, but it was a powerful story. Some years ago, when was it, 2000? When did I get that John Curtin Medal? 2006 or something? Yeah, about 5 years ago. I was awarded a medal from John Curtin University. From Curtin University, it was the John Curtin Medal. They only award one a year, and that was for people in the community, for their community service, or their vision and leadership. And when I received that, I thought, my goodness, community service, that's what you do when you're released from prison. So that can't be it. And vision? It can't be for vision. I have to wear glasses. I've got bad vision. So it must be for leadership. So, when you receive a medal like this, you have to go to the awards. So I had all these important people, you know, and I was given this wonderful medal. And of course, you have to give a speech. So my speech at this awards ceremony went like this. It's a wonderful honor to be given this medal. But, you know, there's so many other people in the community who do much more work and much more important work than I will ever do. And so I really don't know why you're giving it to me and not to all those other heroes in the community. And anyway, I could not have achieved what I've achieved without the help of everybody else, all the monks, the committee, the Buddhist Society, all my friends, all of you. We can't do this alone. But nevertheless, I thank you very much, and it's a great honor. And then I received the medal. Now, because I received a medal, I thought that next year I should go to someone else's medal ceremony. Now, people came to mine, so I should go to theirs. So next year I went along there, and this person who was given the medal the next year, he was actually the Professor Jofi from Charlie Gardner's Hospital. Any of you who've been to Charlie Gardner's for cancer treatment will know that there is the Brown's Alternative Therapy Center, which he started. Because he noticed, he was the head of hematology, and he noticed that all the people who went for treatment in that hospital had state-of-the-art radiation therapy, chemotherapy, or surgery. But as soon as they had their treatment, they left the hospital with no real care. Like a production line. So he really wanted to introduce some follow-up care when people had been through some sort of surgery. So he had this alternative therapy center. He used his power as head of department to actually to clear out a few rooms in that hospital. And he invited people in to do Reiki, homeopathy, reflexology, whatever was weird was allowed in that alternative therapy center. And, you know, he said that, well, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. But what was doing, when somebody was giving you some Reiki or giving you a foot massage, they were caring for you, one-on-one. Someone was spending a half an hour, 20 minutes just with you, massaging your toes. That was the most important part of the therapy. Just, you know, one-on-one care. And all of his friends, because, you know, if you're head of hematology, if you're top professor at a hospital, you know, you're a scientist. And all his friends were saying, you've gone loopy. You know, you've abandoned, you know, the rigor of your intellectual science by all this weird stuff. And he took all of that, but he pressed forward, and it had huge results. And that's why that he was given that medal, for actually having a vision, going against the stream, and pushing it forward, and creating this wonderful help for all these people who have to have radiation, chemotherapy, or surgery, or whatever. What a beautiful thing that was. And I was so inspired when I heard his story. And he got up and gave a speech saying, I don't know why you gave that to me, because there's so many other people in the community who do much more work than I have done. And anyway, I couldn't have achieved this without the help of all my friends and colleagues. And I thought, that was my speech. And you know, if you hear speeches of people who receive prizes or awards, they all give that same speech. And so when I heard him give that speech, I said, you are wrong, Professor Jofre. You deserve that. There's some very smart people in that university has researched you and seen what you've done and realized you've done a marvelous job. And I agree with him. You've done a great job. You really deserve that medal. And so I looked back on my medal and I thought, my God, maybe I deserved it too. And that was a shock to think I actually deserved it. Because I never thought like that. Because I was trained not to think like that. And so from that moment on, I changed the way I deal with praise. If anybody comes up and says, what a marvelous talk that was this evening, I agree with them. I say, yes, you're very discerning and wise. That was a great talk. If anyone says, Ajahn Brahm, you work so hard, you're just a great monk, I said, yeah, thank you, I agree. In other words, from that moment on, I trained myself to receive praise without any embarrassment. And you know what? What that did to me, it actually made me work harder. It didn't make me big-headed. Maybe it made me big-chested, a bit fat, but what it does really, because that's what I was afraid of. I was told, brainwashed as a kid, to say, if you receive praise, you'll get big-headed. You don't get big-headed, you get big-hearted. And also, you don't only get big-hearted if you receive the praise, all this terrible lack of self-esteem, thinking you're not good enough, thinking that, you know, you can't be happy because you don't deserve it, feeling guilty every time you have a good time, that disappears. When you have received the praise, your heart grows, self-esteem is established, and you are now free to be happy. There's a few people on the retreat recently in the interviews. I said, look, if you don't understand this, I, on headed note paper, will give you a declaration and I will sign it. I hereby grant you permission to be happy. Signed, Ajahn Brahm. You know that sometimes that works? Because sometimes people, you get close to happiness, but you break it up. You know that's happened with a lot of people in, say, relationships. You know, you find a nice partner in life. Have you ever been one of those people, you find a nice partner, but it all goes wrong? And you wonder, why? Why does it always happen? And the reason is you get so far, you're close to happiness, and something comes up and says, no, not for me, I don't deserve such happiness. You destroy it. And it's because you've had so much criticism, and you haven't received praise, we feel guilty. Someone asked me just on the retreat, said, surely in some times guilt is good, because if you feel guilty for something, you won't do it again. But it's not the case. If you feel guilty for something you've done in the past, you'll find you do it again. How many times do people in prison, once they get released, they've been told they're guilty. They're there for days, weeks, months, years, and everything is telling them they're guilty. And they go out and they reoffend again. Feeling you're guilty doesn't stop you reoffending. In fact, it makes it more likely to reoffend. You know why? I'm guilty. I'm not worth anything. I'm hopeless anyway. What the hell? And then you don't have any of this self-confidence which makes things like keeping precepts, being good and virtuous, possible. So, when you feel guilty about something, superficially you will think that, okay, that's really good. Maybe that's going to stop me reoffending. It doesn't work that way. Instead of feeling guilty, we have to feel good about ourselves. Let it go. You made a mistake. Write it on the toilet paper and put it in the toilet and flush it away. Let it go. But the good stuff in life, the praise, the good things you've done in your life, please keep them. And then you feel, yes, you have got self-esteem. I'll give you another simile. Now, I've been the abbot of the monastery in Serpentine. How long now for Dennis? About 15 years now, ever since. I've been, 18 years now, I think. For about 10 years, Ajahn Jaka was the abbot first, and then I took over. 18 years now. That's really hard work. Running a monastery. And that's only half of the, quarter of the thing which I have to do. And what was happening to me as the abbot of a monastery? I was in charge. I was responsible. And because of that, what was going on? I would come here on a Friday afternoon, just like I came this afternoon. And I come and talk with the president, the dentist, get some sort of things out of the way, administration problems or whatever, have a cup of tea and come out here and talk with you and then give a meditation and talk and stay here afterwards. And Saturday, the same thing, and Sunday as well. Sunday afternoon, I go back to monastery at Serpentine, make sure the monks were all okay, take the calls, which had problems which had happened on the weekend. And then Monday morning, we'd actually teaching the monks and looking after the monastery, doing administration, building work, the whole work. It was 7 days a week. I knew I never needed to do that, but I thought I should. I know that people would come and visit Bodhinyana Monastery, as you do now, and you'd all say, oh, what a beautiful monastery this is. How lucky you are to live there. And I would think, I wouldn't tell you this, I would think, are you blind? There's so much work to do here. All the gutters need to be clean. I've got to write all these letters. People are emailing me, asking me questions about their meditation. And I've got all this other work to do. I'm supposed to be writing another book, Open the Door of Your Heart, number 2, and I can't get time to do it. And people are asking me emails about coming from the youth group in Buddhist Fellowship. They want to sort of get my advice on something, and then somebody else asked me about something else. And, it's so much work. And what do you mean, a nice, peaceful place? This monastery is hell. That was some years ago. And then I realized, why is it that whenever I was staying in that monastery, I only saw all the problems which needed to be fixed, all the things which were wrong which needed to be mended, all the duties which I hadn't yet done? Why did I see that? So I made this resolution that every Monday morning that I would walk around Bodhinyana Monastery, where I was a boss monk, as a visitor, not as an owner. When I imagined I was a visitor, I saw it like you saw it. This beautiful monastery, just so peaceful and calm, I enjoyed it. And I realized from that, there's a huge difference when you're a visitor from when you're an owner. And that to me was the trick of learning how to relax and let go. When you're an owner of something, you have responsibility. You see all the things which need to be fixed up because you have that responsibility. You're the manager. But when you're the visitor, you're free. That's somebody else's problem. So I decided every now and again when I was tired, in order to relax and let go, I had to be a visitor, not an owner. So if you want to have a nice weekend in your house or apartment, if you're the owner, there's so many jobs you have to do, and you will never find any peace at all. So maybe just one afternoon, maybe you have to get your wife's permission first of all, or your husband's permission, just look at your house and think, no, today or this morning I'll be a visitor. And I would enjoy my apartment, my house as a visitor, not as an owner. So it doesn't matter if things need to be washed or vacuumed or whatever. If you go and visit somebody's house, do you vacuum the floor for them? No, it's not your business. So you can actually relax for a while. Because you're not an owner anymore. You're a visitor. And I took that much further. Not only could I relax in my monastery, whenever I wanted to, I was a visitor, not an owner anymore. So I could be relaxed. I could see it as a visitor sees it, appreciate it as a visitor sees it, enjoy it as a visitor sees it, not as an owner. And then I started to extend that, to sort of even my body. How many times are you worried about your body, exercising it, sort of washing it, sort of eating the right food and stuff like that? It's endless, isn't it? All you have to do to look after this body. So sometimes I thought, right, today I'm going to be lazy. It's not my body, I'm a visitor. That's actually what the Buddha actually said. you only visit this body for 60, 80, 90 years, and then bye-bye body, you go get another one. So it's only temporary anyway. So maybe once a week, you just are a visitor to this body, you don't own it. And then, you know, you can enjoy it, have fun with it. You're not so worried about keeping it healthy or keeping it fit. So if you're a visitor, you can eat whatever you want. Which brings me to the little advert today. You may have seen on the posters outside that in 9 days' time, we're going to be having the food fair. Now, the food fair is actually to raise money for things, because we don't charge you when you come in here. We actually said that. The idea was to have no entrance fee, so you can come in here for free, but have a box in there you have to pay to go out. Now, that would be really, really good. Because if you go out early, you have to pay more, and you stay longer, the price goes down. That keeps people listening to the talks. But no, we're not into that sort of stuff. So you come in and out for free. But to raise money to keep this place, you know, we have these food fairs every now and again. And especially this time, it's actually for the nuns' monastery. If you've ever been to Dharamsala Nuns' Monastery, look, we have monks and nuns as well. Not just monks, but nuns. We try and have equity. It's the 21st century. You know, men and women. You know, not sort of just one-sided. So, you know, we've been trying to do that. And you all know the history. I got into trouble for, you know, pushing the ordination of women. But it's not just pushing the ordination of women. Once they are got the ordination, they need a place to stay. So we've got this beautiful monastery up in Gijigan of Dharamsala. If you haven't been there yet, you should go there. But, you know, it's so popular now, they need more accommodation and build a proper hall. So they've got the same facilities as the monks have got, but that costs money. So we're raising funds for the food fair. This will be for the nuns' monastery. So all you women, please come along and support it. You know, it's for you. And all you men, you know, to make sure you don't get scolded by your wives, you've got to come as well and support it. And because it's going to be on the 27th, which is on the Sunday, please, if you really are, especially you who are really devout Buddhists, if you really, really want to make some good karma, please, on Saturday the 26th, please don't cook any food for your husband. So he has to fast, so the next day on the 27th, he can eat twice as much food, therefore we can make twice as much. So, this is actually just, you know, sort of how, you know, we raise funds for these things, of having a food fair. But because it's food for a good purpose, because of the law of karma, it's actually holy food. You know, it's because it's sold in the temple. And because it's holy food, that means you don't have to worry about the sugar content or the oil content, because the good karma just balances that. So you can eat as much as you like. You can pig out. You don't have to worry about the cholesterol or the sugar level, because that's all looked after, you know, by good karma. So it's a great excuse to eat as much as you like with no guilt, because we don't believe in guilt in this place. So anyhow, you know, sometimes I really wonder about some of these health things, because one of my favorite sayings was from that comedian, George Burns. Remember George Burns, the American comedian? I think he died, was in 99. He almost made 100, but not quite. And on his 96th birthday, 96 years of age, he was still performing. Not just performing, he was also going to bars and nightclubs, smoking cigarettes and eating greasy hamburgers. And in his interview, the interviewer asked him this question, aren't you worried about your health? You know, you're 96 years of age and you're staying up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. You should be in old people's home, not in a nightclub. Not only that, you smoke all these cigars, you drink whiskey by the litre, and you eat all this, you know, greasy food. Aren't you worried about your health? And his answer was, I'm not worried about my health. My wife was worried about my health, and that's why she died 20 years ago. I love that saying. It's the worry kills you much more than the grease does. So you come here, no worries, and you'll be okay. If you do die, I better get a ticket to another country because you might sue me. But no. So it's the worry which is the worst thing about these things, and the guilt which comes up from these things. And that's not really a good way to live a life. So instead of having that guilt and that worry, we can actually learn how to let go of these things. A little bit of praise. And also a little bit of looking at your body not as a resident, but as a visitor. So not as an owner. And the whole idea changes. Not only that, even your mind as well. As soon as you think you're an owner, then you can't relax and enjoy things. Those of you, again, with kids. I remember that my mother always used to be, you know, tell me I couldn't eat this and I couldn't eat that. And I'd spoil my lunch, I'd spoil my dinner. But I used to go and visit my grandma. And my grandma would give me anything. And, you know, because my grandmother was, you know, almost like senior to my mother couldn't argue with her. So I go there in the afternoon and my grandma would say, do you want some chips? Oh, yeah. So just make me a plate of chips. My mother would never do that. It's bad for you. And that's why I love my grandma. And isn't that the case, you know, with you do anything for your grandchildren. That's why grandchildren love you, because you don't own them. Because you don't own them, you can enjoy them. Now, it's your mother's job to be responsible, but as a grandparent, you're not responsible at all. You can just enjoy their company and their grandchildren can enjoy your company. You see how wonderful it is when you don't own things? So why do mum and dad do the same and enjoy the company of their kids, and the kids enjoy the company of their mum and dad? So you don't own them. You can enjoy their company, you can love them. Instead of always having to sort of tell them they're doing something wrong. How many times, this is a great little test for you. Again, if you've got kids, just keep a record. You know, maybe sort of tape your conversations and count how many times you criticize your kids in one day and how many times you praise them. And if you actually counted just in one ordinary day, you'd be shocked. You understand the problem. Basically, 90% of the time you put your kids down. And that's what they hear. At least it should be 50-50. And I say, actually, you know, even more than that. Praise your kids way up to here. And only a little bit of criticism. Now, try the same with the way you speak to your husband. The way you speak to your wife. And then you understand why relationships go wrong in Australia. Why the divorce rate is so high. Yeah, I mean, you don't mean that, so you say, but that's what they hear. Always criticism, always putting down. What about at work? And at work, that's the same thing. People work so hard and your boss says, not good enough, too late. How many times does the boss come and say, great job, well done, brilliant, you're a great worker, you're brilliant, we're so lucky to have you here. Has your boss said that to you today, or last week, or ever? Wouldn't it be wonderful if your boss said that to you? Wow, a boss actually appreciates me. And you'd actually want to work harder for a boss like that. That's actually what I do, to get all these monks to work hard for me. I'd say, you're just Ajahn Abhichata, you're just so great teacher, you're a wonderful meditator, oh, just so lucky to have you here. And that way I can get him to give the talk next week. This is a joke. He knows that I'm not just joking. I actually do that. Because what actually happens is you're encouraging people and they actually raise their game. And even when people are meditating, you know, sometimes I've been teaching some of these people who come on a retreat for about, actually, 20 years now. And they're still dumb meditators. They still can't get themselves into deep meditation. But I never tell them that. I hope they don't listen to this talk. Instead, what I say, amazing, well done, you're making progress. Yeah, good on you. It's amazing just, you know, what you've done in all these years, even though it's only something tiny, because that encourages people. And with that encouragement, actually they do get better, they do raise their game. And that way, you get much more out of them. You get much more out of your wife. Darling, you're so beautiful. You know, even though you're 70, you know, I was so lucky to meet you. You know, it's amazing that sort of, you know, I've had you as my partner for life. And we praise them. It's amazing. Just try it out. It gets you everywhere. Flattery gets you everywhere. Whoever said flattery gets you nowhere doesn't know psychology. It gets you everywhere. A bit of praise. You know, this is an old story. When we first moved to monastery at Bodhinyana in Serpentine, that was 28 years ago, I can remember that much. And we had to do all the building ourselves. So I was the builder, you know, laying concrete, bricks, but also had to do the plumbing as well. The first ablution box, showers and toilets, so at least we could have some place to, you know, do our business. So I did the plumbing for that. You know actually how I did it? I didn't know anything about plumbing. Before that, I was a theoretical physicist, okay? I mean, that really is in your head, big time. You know, working about the meaning of the universe and black holes and cosmic rays or whatever, that's, you know, up here somewhere. And to lay pipes, to get your hands dirty, I'd never done that before. So the way I did this, Dennis here, he wrote out the plans. He's been doing the plans for years. So he gave the plans, and I took them to the plumbing shop and said, help. I actually did that. Put it on the counter and said, look, we've got to do this. Can you help? And of course, there was lots of pipes from the plumbing shop. And the guy behind the counter, this guy Fred, I don't know whatever's happened to him because it's 28 years ago, he actually spent about 15 or 20 minutes with me. So getting out the parts, you know, how do they fit together? It was all reasonable and logical. You've got to get a certain fall. It's 1 in 40. Too much, and the water goes too quickly and leaves, you know, the feces there, and it dries and blocks up. Too level, and in case it doesn't flow either. So you just got to get the right amount. And he showed me how to glue the whole things together. It's pretty simple. And he sort of gave me all the instructions. And then he worked out what we needed. And so, you know, a lot of stuff which we got, and took it all back down to Serpentine, and I just figured it all out, glued it all together. But, you know, you can't just use the toilets once it's all glued together. You get the health inspector came. And I was so nervous. It's the first time you did anything. And if it was wrong, there's a lot of money which the Buddhist Society would have wasted. And what they had to do was, you know, bung up the ends and pour water in to see if there was any leaks. And I think it was because I did a lot of chanting beforehand, there was no leaks. But something worked, he passed it. And I was so happy, you know, that we passed the first thing which I really did. This was before the brickwork. And I was so happy. It was actually the next day we got the bill for all the parts. And I got a check out, you know, from the treasurer. And I sent it in an envelope with a letter. Now saying, no, thank you, Fred. Thank you so much. You know, that 10 or 15 minutes you spent with me, you know, you told me how to put these things together and it worked. It's just been passed yesterday by the health inspector. You know, we got our ablution blocks. Thank you so much, Fred. And then I put it in the envelope with a check, posted it, and it was actually, you know, well, I don't mind saying, why not? You know, the Galvin's plumbing. And I was just didn't really know so much about these things, and I thought they would go straight to Fred. But this was a big company, so it goes to the accounts department. And in the accounts department, this little clerk opens the envelope, sees a check and a letter. Oh, my God, another complaint. Because apparently the only time you send a letter, you know, to a company like that is to complain about something. And he read it, and it wasn't a complaint. It was actually a compliment, praising. So he sent it to the head of the accounts department, who read it. Wow, someone likes us. And he sent it to the managing director. And the managing director read it and got straight on the telephone to Fred in Osborne Park Galvin's and said, because Fred told me this afterwards, and he said something like, Fred, I've just got a letter from one of your customers. Oh, sorry, sir. No, it's a good letter. He's praising you. You've done a really great job. It's customer service. Oh, yes, sir. Yeah, that's what we always do. This is the way forward in our company. Oh, yes, I do try my best, sir. This is a brilliant. Well done, Fred. Oh, it's all right, sir. How much are you on? What salary are you on, Fred? Well, you can always do a little bit better, sir. We will. And I know that because about an hour later, I had to go into that shop. Because there was one part for another job which was too small. I needed about twice the size.
And when I went into that shop, there were these Australian plumbers, about three, in line ahead of me. You know, really big, with shoulders as big as septic tanks, that's how I put it. You know, I know how Australian plumbers are, big guys. And when Fred saw me, "Bob, come over here." And those big plumbers had to wait. You know, I was given priority service. And I didn't know what was going on until, you know, the other person serving, and he said, "No, Fred thinks you're his wife. He's just got the call from the managing director because of that letter you sent." And because of that little bit of praise, which had, you know, gone all the way to the managing director, the managing director gave this personal call to Fred and gave him a lift in his salary. Fred gave me this VIP service. And he said, "What do you want, bruv?" I said, "Look, I got this part here and it's too small." He said, "Oh, we can fix that up. You come around the back." I said, "Look, there's a sign there. You know, no plumbers or customers are allowed around the back." He said, "That's all right for you. Come on." So he brought me around the back. "What do you want?" And I found the part, you know, which was twice as deep. It's about four or five times the price. And so I said to Fred, "What's the difference?" And he smiled and said, "For you, Bram, no difference." And that's such a wonderful experience. So the Buddhist Society, we saved a lot of money like that. And all it was just one little letter of praise saying thank you. And what a wonderful job you did. And I remember that experience today. And it was, what a brilliant story that is. Just the power of a little bit of kindness and encouragement and praise and building people up. So, you know, even sometimes you're supposed to be, you know, truthful, keep your precepts, but you can stretch the truth a little bit in those areas and praise people, really, you know, find something. And that way, everybody wins. A happier world, you're not so fault-finding, you can relax. So I look at my monastery these days, it's a beautiful monastery. Yeah, there's all sorts of things which need to be done and things which can always be improved, but no, it's a beautiful monastery. Jada Grove is a beautiful, this place over here. Now we're supposed to be painting it, but yeah, maybe because I've just developed this lack of fault-finding mind, it looks beautiful. You look at your garden, all those beautiful weeds growing up, it's natural, wonderful, it's just so beautiful, so nice. So then actually you can relax a bit more. But those of you who always found faults, you're perfectionists, there's no end to it. And worst of all, to come back to where I started, you look at yourself. "Oh, I'm hopeless. I'm terrible. I'm really awful. I tell really bad jokes." And, you know, I keep on telling, it's not just they're bad jokes. I tell the same ones every other week. "Oh, it's really, 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 really terrible. Okay, what's a good bad joke today?" Oh, this is one of the old bad jokes. I don't think I've told. But I only tell religious jokes, okay? Because, you know, this is like a church, a temple. So this is a religious joke. This is a Pope joke. Pope jokes. Why are you... Already you're laughing because Pope jokes are funny. So, okay, the Pope was, you know, visiting Western Australia. Visiting Perth. And he got picked up at the airport in a limousine, of course. And being picked up in a limousine, he was sitting in the back and the driver, you know, in a nice suit, was driving him along. And as they stopped at one of the traffic lights, you know, the Pope said, "Look, you know, there's no one around. Will you let me drive? Because, you know, I'm a Pope, I don't get the chance to drive. But, you know, I'm visiting Western Australia, no one will know." And I said, "I can't let you drive." And he said, the Pope says, "Look, you know, are you Catholic?" He said, "Of course I am. Look, I'll forgive all your sins if you let me drive." Because popes can do that. So he said, "Well, okay. Actually, I might get into trouble with this talk, but never mind. Too late now." So they exchanged seats. And so the chauffeur was sitting in the back. And the Pope was driving. And it's the first time he'd driven in years. So he really put his foot down. Whoa! And of course, you know what happens. The very first time he sped, he only sped once. And a motorcycle cop saw him. And he sort of drove alongside of him. "Now, turn down your window and pull over." And imagine the traffic cop, seeing it was a Pope speeding in a car. So he got on his phone
know, to the headquarters in East Perth. And he said, look, we've got a problem. I need some backup. What? What's wrong? He said, look, I've just caught this car. It was speeding. There's a really important person in the front. He said, don't care. Book him. You know, this is Australia. We don't care who it is. Book him. He said, look, I can't. It's really, really important. I don't care. Book him. Who is it? Look, I don't know who's sitting in the back, but the Pope's his chauffeur. So that's a bad joke. It's a terrible joke. It's an old joke. But I can't help myself. So every evening after I tell a bad joke like this, I forgive myself. Never mind, Ajahn Brahm. It's just who I am. So that way, so you can have a good time and enjoy yourself. So the moral of this whole thing is, why not allow yourself to be happy? You deserve to be happy. So all this thing about looking at your faults and thinking, I'm guilty, I don't deserve to be happy, stand in the corner, you bad boy, you bad girl. Please have a look at that. That's created so much harm in your life already. People already told you so many times, you're a bad person, you're not good enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not clever enough, you're not smart enough, you're not earning enough money, you're not doing this or whatever. Now is the time for you to say, no. You look at yourself, I'm okay. I'm not the best, never will be, but the Buddha said middle way. So I'm in the middle there somewhere, not too bad, not too good. No, average, and that in Buddhism is the best. So that way you can be at peace with yourself. And being at peace with yourself opens the door to happiness. Being at peace with yourself, yeah, you're not the best, but remember all the beautiful things you've done. All the successful things you've done in life. All the amazing things you've achieved. You have done all of that, you know. Each one of you. Great things you've achieved. Are you accepting that praise? Or you're thinking, that's a crazy monk. I haven't achieved anything. You know, I'm not the best. Other people maybe, but not me. And I could have done what I've done without the help of other people. Please never give that speech. If someone says, thank you, wonderful thing you've done. You've been so kind to come and help, you know, with the food fair. You've been so wonderful, you know, to fast on Saturdays so you can eat twice as much on the 27th of November. You're wonderful people, great people, such a sacrifice, you're so marvellous. Accept it. That's if you have to do it, first of all, before you accept it. But accept the praise, because that gives you a really good heart, a big heart, and it means that all this criticism which you get in the world disappears. In the office, you learn how to praise other people. When you send a bill in, you put a letter of praise, thank you. Was there one of the monks, he was, what did he have? He had some sort of sickness some years ago. He was in the hospital for about a week. You know what he did? After he was in the hospital for a week, he wrote a letter to, I think it was McGuinty, he was the health minister at the time. Saying, well, I had such a wonderful time in the hospital. They looked after him. The nurses, the doctors were so good. He wrote a letter. And there was a health minister in Western Australia. And McGuinty wrote him a letter back, a personal one. Thank you so much for appreciating all the work we did. It's very rare I get a letter like this. And he got a personal letter back. So why don't you try that? You know, if you've been sort of in the hospital, they looked after you. Write a letter to the health minister. They probably know by now it must come from the disciple of Ajahn Brahm, because that's the only one who does things like that. But anyhow, it's a great thing to do. Imagine being the health minister. Imagine being Julia Gillard. Imagine being all these other people. They always get this criticism and put down all the time. And you know, just write a letter to Julia Gillard. Thank you. At least you're not Saddam Hussein. We're so lucky not to have a Muhammad Gaddafi. Or whatever. But no, at least you show some appreciation. And that makes the life a much better place. You get more out of people. And of course, coming back to the very beginning, to praise yourself. You're not that bad. Can you accept that? Sometimes you have to do that day after day after day. I deserve to be happy. I'm okay. Praise yourself.
Look in the mirror. Because you're looking at the person you're going to be with for the rest of your life. And make friends. Respect. And then when you praise yourself, praising yourself means you can allow yourself to be happy. You get much better out, much more out of your day, out of the rest of your years. And those of you who want to meditate, if you don't respect yourself, you find the mind will always be wandering off. Why does the mind wander off when you try and meditate? Why does it think about this, thinking about that? Because you don't like yourself, that's why. You always try and get away. Thinking, planning, fantasies, dreams, all because you're a bit worried. If you face yourself, you won't like what you see. But after a while, when you like yourself, when you're at peace with yourself, you accept yourself, it's very easy to hang out with yourself. And that's what meditation is. Hanging out in the present moment with yourself instead of running off going somewhere else. So if you can hang out with you, then you're at peace with yourself. You know how to meditate. You know how the secret of life. And all this lack of self-esteem business totally disappears. You like yourself. So you give yourself the very, very best. So that's how to have peace of mind. Great meditation. No more lack of self-esteem. Success, happiness, good relationships, everything. And that's the talk tonight. Was it a good talk? Yes, I deserve that.
Thank you.
Thank you. You are so discerning. I agree with you. Okay. So any questions or comments about this evening's talk? Yes. Another joke. I've got to repeat this for the thing. Errol Flynn, a bit of a hellraiser. Carry on. Decides to reform. Okay, so him and his friends go to confession box to tell their sins. Yeah. Yeah, so he tells his sins, and the priest gives them $50 each. Yeah. And the Errol Flynn says to the priest, "Why do you give us $50 each when we tell you our sins?" He says it to the priest. Okay, I've got to repeat this because I started it. And the priest says, "Well, we put a tape recorder at the bottom, so I give you $50, but I sell the tapes to Playboy magazine for $100 each." There's another. Okay, here we go. It's another confession box joke. This drunk goes into the confession box, just really drunk, and he sits in the box, and the priest is waiting for him, and the drunk just sits there, and the priest knocks to show that the priest is there, and the drunk is quiet, and the priest knocks again to get the drunk's attention, and the drunk is quiet again, and he knocks another time. "Look, I'm here," said the priest, and the drunk says, "Yes, I know you're here, but there's no toilet paper in this cubicle either." Okay, that's enough for this evening. Okay. Not my fault, just my conditioning.